Hey, What's News listeners, this is Luke Vargas, and we want to hear from you about what you like about the show and which episodes of What's News you usually listen to, whether that's usually the AM or PM edition, both, or whatever's most recent. If you're listening on Spotify, look for our poll under the episode description or send us an email to wnpod@wsj.com. Thanks to so many of you for already reaching out. And now, on to the show. A Chinese spy balloon used U.S. equipment to spy on Americans. Plus, how chemotherapy shortages could affect hundreds of thousands of patients. And Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu searches for a middle ground on controversial judicial reforms and the war in Ukraine.
We have concerns that I don't think any of the Western allies of Ukraine have.
It's Thursday, June 29th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News. The top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We are exclusively reporting that the Chinese spy balloon that floated over the U.S. earlier this year used American-made technology to spy on Americans. That is according to U.S. officials who said that the equipment, some of which was commercially available, along with more specialized Chinese sensors, helped the balloon to collect photos, videos, and other information to transmit back to China. They added that those findings support the conclusion that the balloon was for spying and not weather monitoring, as Beijing had said. The White House and the defense and intelligence agencies involved in the investigation of the balloon declined to comment. Chinese officials have expressed concern that should the U.S. investigators' report on the balloon become public, that Beijing would be forced to react strongly. Fed Chair Jerome Powell says that a series of bank failures earlier this year underscore the need for stronger regulation and supervision of lenders. Speaking at a conference in Madrid today, Powell said he looked forward to reviewing proposals for strengthening the Fed's supervisory powers and, quote, implementing them where appropriate. The Fed has come under fire in recent months for its role in easing supervision of mid-sized banks, following bipartisan legislation signed by former President Donald Trump in 2018. Powell's comments come as the results of a Fed stress test of America's biggest banks found that all 23 that participated remain healthy. Journal financial regulation reporter Andrew Ackerman told us that given the bank failures earlier in the year, those results serve as a vote of confidence for the financial system.
The main purpose of the test is to show that banks can survive a hypothetical severe recession where unemployment jumps dramatically, all these asset prices decline dramatically as well, and still come out way above their capital minimums.
And Russian cargo ships sanctioned by the U.S. have been regularly calling at Turkish ports since the invasion of Ukraine began, potentially making the NATO member a crucial plank in Moscow's broader war effort. According to shipping records seen by the Wall Street Journal, the sanctioned Russian vessels have made more than 100 stops at ports along Turkey's coast since May 2022, and those stops have continued in recent weeks. The port calls threaten to further inflame relations between the U.S. and Turkey, which is the only NATO member that hasn't sanctioned the Kremlin. The Russian and Turkish governments didn't respond to requests for comments on the matter. Coming up, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sat down with a journal this week to talk court reform, support for Ukraine, and where things stand with the U.S. We've got that story and more after the break.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sat down this week with the Wall Street Journal for an exclusive interview in Jerusalem. In a wide-ranging conversation, he said he was open to finding middle ground on key issues, both domestic and foreign, from a contentious judicial overhaul to the war in Ukraine, all while remaining defiant about an ongoing corruption trial. The Journal's Dov Lieber spoke to Netanyahu, and Dov joins me now from Tel Aviv. Dov, this is the sixth term for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, no small feat, quite a political accomplishment, and yet he faces an array of domestic challenges. How is he approaching those?
That's correct. This is the sixth term, and it's definitely not an easy one. He has a number of very serious challenges, but one of the things we spoke about in the interview is about his major domestic challenges, and that is pushing through a judicial reform or judicial overhaul that will radically change the balance of power between the courts and the executive branch and the parliament. In our interview, he said that he was going to advance this legislation unilaterally. He had paused it earlier in March because there were these nation-paralyzing protests that had forced Netanyahu really to pause on legislation. Then he entered these talks with the opposition, but those broke down very recently. And now he's saying he's just going to pass this legislation unilaterally, but he's going to do a more measured package, more measured reform. He's going to do it in a way that's in a public consensus, just not in consensus with the opposition parties.
Dov, Netanyahu also talked about the war in Ukraine, saying he is supportive of Ukraine, but also that he won't make available to Kyiv the air defense system known as the Iron Dome, and he explained why. Let's take a listen.
If that system were to fall in the hands of Iran, then the millions of Israelis would be left defenseless and imperiled. So we have concerns that I don't think any of the Western allies of Ukraine have. I don't think Germany or France or Britain, or the U.S. have that concern. We do.
We should note that Ukraine's ambassador to Israel has called fears of weaponry ending up in Iranian hands, quote, entirely fictional and speculative assumptions, end quote. Dov, you have been watching Netanyahu's remarks throughout the war. What do you make of these comments and this distinction he is drawing here between Israeli support for Ukraine and support from a key ally, the United States?
Well, in this case, the fact that U.S. senators are pushing for supplying Ukraine with Iron Dome is very sensitive for Israel. And what Netanyahu is saying is that we just can't afford it. It's just too risky for Israel. Israel is under constant rocket fire by Palestinian militants in Lebanon and Syria. It's a very serious threat. And the one thing that keeps all these Israelis safe, it's not the one thing, but the major thing, is the Iron Dome system. And what he's arguing is that if somehow it's captured in Russia, it could be transferred to the Iranians. They could reverse engineer the Iron Dome system, and that would leave millions of Israelis in harm's way.
How is the overall relationship between Israel and the U.S. going? You're speaking to at least some difference of opinion here as it pertains to Ukraine. Is it bigger than that?
Yeah, well, this is kind of a very difficult time for the relationship between the executive branch or between the government of Israel and the government of the United States. This is very important because, as Netanyahu says in the interview, the security relationship between Israel and the United States is very good right now, perhaps better than it's ever been. But we're talking about the political relationship between the Netanyahu administration and the Biden administration. And here, Netanyahu has known President Biden for four decades. He says they have a friendly relationship. And yet, Netanyahu hasn't been invited to the White House. And this is a pretty strange thing for the relationship between Israel and the United States. Netanyahu says he'll get this meeting with Biden at some point. But we don't know when that is. And for now, it seems that the relationship is at a very strained point.
And finally, Dov, the last thing I want to ask about is what it would take in Netanyahu's eyes to reach a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians. Here is one element of what he had to say about that.
I think peace is possible with additional Arab states. I think effectively ending the Arab-Israeli conflict, not the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I think that would lead to peace with the Palestinians, too.
Dov, is this a new line for Israel?
This has been Netanyahu's primary theory now for a while. For many years, the international community and many in Israel believed he had to make peace with the Palestinians. Then you can make peace with the rest of the region and the rest of the Muslim world. And he believes that the Abraham Accords, the peace deals that Israel had in 2020 with certain countries here in the region, is evidence that his theory is really effective and actually working.
And the Palestinian response to that has been...
Well, the Palestinians haven't budged. I mean, they're not very happy with the idea of Arab states making peace with Israel before the Palestinians because they lose leverage. They're still demanding the same things they've been demanding now for many years, which is an independent state, with East Jerusalem as its capital. So it's still a standoff between the Israelis and the Palestinians politically. It doesn't look like there's any potential for peace negotiations anywhere in the near future. So that's where we are today.
That was The Wall Street Journal's Dov Lieber joining us this morning from Tel Aviv. And to hear his full interview with Benjamin Netanyahu, head on over to WSJ.com. Dov, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
In other news, moving the world today, up to 500,000 patients in the United States could be at risk of having their treatment disrupted amid a months-long shortage of chemotherapies used to fight cancer and treat chronic diseases. That is according to the chief medical officer at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Journal Health reporter Brianna Abbott told me what's at the root of the problem.
Yeah, so these shortages started several months ago, and it really sort of gets back to this one manufacturing facility, Intas Pharmaceuticals in India. And the FDA late last year flagged quality problems at the facility. And so there was the production of cisplatin and carboplatin, which are two very common critical chemotherapies, was temporarily shut down. And that sort of sparked this current round of shortages. And shortages for chemotherapies sort of aren't uncommon. This is a really bad one, but a lot of it gets to the root issue of the fact that these are very old generic drugs. And so their prices are not very high. They're actually pretty cheap. And so what that does is not a lot of manufacturers want to manufacture them because they don't make a lot of profit. And so what happens is if you have quality issues in one plant, it can really just unravel the entire market because there aren't necessarily enough manufacturers to step in when one of them goes under.
And Brianna, are there patients who are having their treatment affected now?
Definitely. So there are patients, it's not the majority, but there are patients who have received less of a dose, or there have been lengthened times between treatments, or they've had to start a second line protocol and sort of not start with these drugs at all in the first place. So this is definitely affecting patients in real time. And we don't know what the survival outcomes or impact of that is going to be yet. But it is something that has doctors very concerned.
That was Wall Street Journal health reporter Brianna Abbott. Wreckage from the Titan submersible, including presumed human remains, was handed over to the U.S. Coast Guard on Wednesday after being pulled ashore in Newfoundland, Canada. Five people died in what was believed to be an implosion of the sub while on an expedition to the wreckage of the Titanic in the North Atlantic. The Coast Guard said debris and evidence were recovered from the sea floor and will be transported to the U.S. for further analysis, adding that U.S. medical professionals will analyze the presumed human remains, which were recovered within the wreckage. And the heads of Microsoft and Activision Blizzard have defended a planned $75 billion merger, saying it wouldn't block competition if approved, with the CEOs of both companies saying Wednesday they would continue to make their games available on other gaming platforms besides Microsoft's Xbox. The Federal Trade Commission is seeking a preliminary injunction to block Microsoft from closing the deal, arguing it could stifle competition, including in the growing cloud gaming market. And finally, how would you feel about working into your 80s? 80-year-old Harrison Ford's latest Indiana Jones film just released. Jane Goodall, 89, is still protecting chimps, and 80-year-old Joe Biden is president. But it's not just high-profile individuals. According to the Census Bureau, roughly 650,000 Americans over age 80 were working last year, which is about 18% more than a decade earlier. And WSJ reporter Callum Borchers explains some of the reasons behind this trend.
We know there are some people who do it because they have no choice, right? I mean, inflation has certainly put the squeeze on some people's retirement savings, so they've had to come out of retirement. I'm primarily curious, though, about the people for whom they don't have to. They don't need the paycheck. You sort of have to dig past the jokes, because if you ask somebody in their 80s, oh, why do you keep on working? Usually you get something silly like, oh, I got bored on the golf course, or, you know, my husband won't let me sit around idle in the house. But once you sort of press past that, it really is much simpler. They just plain want to. Work is something that is part of their identities, and giving it up feels really difficult to do. And there's even this underlying, I'll call it fear for some of them. I don't think that's too strong to say that some are afraid of becoming irrelevant if they hang it up.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.